The Titans of Trial podcast is sponsored by the Florida Justice Association Research and Education Foundation, promoting the study and understanding of Florida's civil justice system and how its preservation benefits consumers, victims, and all Floridians. Learn more at floridajusticeassociation.org.
From the Florida Justice Association, these are the Titans of Trial.
The thing that I found most interesting about the tobacco case was that we fought as hard for the non-economic portion of the agreement than we did of the direct money recovery.
Mike Mayer shares the other victory behind the victory of Florida's big tobacco case and takes us inside the settlement room with Governor Childs.
And the governor very calmly looked at him and said, "I'm not worried about the money." He said, "I'm worried about all of the non-economic things because I'm either going to be criticized or remembered because of those things."
And the mantra that's guided him in his nearly half century of practicing personal injury law.
I'm a big believer in doing the right thing for the right reason. And it sounds very simplistic, and it is simplistic, but it's very hard to do consistently.
Welcome to Titans of Trial, featuring the personal stories of the men and women who've made a difference to the practice of trial law in Florida. I am Paul Jess, Executive Director of the Florida Justice Association. Imagine working on a big case with your team and then leaving town without them to try to settle the case before the trial starts. Well, that's the situation that Mike Mayer of Orlando found himself in back in 1997. As chairman of the so-called Group of Nine Dream Team of Florida Trial Lawyers, Mike negotiated the $13-plus billion settlement from Big Tobacco to the state of Florida for Medicaid recoupment costs on sick smokers. In just a few minutes, you'll hear his story of what happened behind the scenes with Governor Childs and those big tobacco lawyers. But if not for his father's untimely death, Mike would have most likely become an engineer. Instead, he headed to Stetson Law School and became one of Florida's top trial lawyers by engineering innovative solutions for his clients. Mike is a former president of the American Association for Justice, as well as a former president of the Florida Justice Association. An Eagle founder, Mike has been honored with the Al J. Cohn Lifetime Achievement Award and the B.J. Masterson Award. On the eve of his 50th anniversary practicing law, Mike Mayer sat down with Florida Justice Association radio host Harvey Bennett in February 2018 to talk about his remarkable career, his view of the legal profession, and his surprising advice on the best way to get new clients.
Mike, you were one of the lawyers who represented the state of Florida against Big Tobacco in the mid-1990s to recoup taxpayer losses for Medicaid treatment for smokers. It was a $13-plus billion settlement. That must have been an amazing case to work on.
It was a terrific case to work on for many reasons, in that about midway through the case, I was directed by the governor and the attorney general to go to Washington and New York to be involved in the direct negotiations of settlement. One of the difficult parts about it was I was not allowed, by direction from the governor and the AG, to talk to any of the team members that I was doing that. They were very respectful of the law and the rules that the corporations were more worried about than we were. For instance, once I got involved in that, it was a very interesting process. The thing that I found most interesting about the tobacco case was that we fought as hard for the non-economic portion of the agreement than we did of the direct money recovery. And if you want me to at this point in time, I can tell you a story about a trial.
Please do.
We were involved in the trial in West Palm Beach. We were the second case to try nationally. Mississippi was first on the docket, and they settled before their case started. They got an agreement of a substantial sum of money. It was a top recovery, but they didn't get and were unable to get the industry to agree to the non-economics. Joe Camel, signs within 1,000 feet of schools, any of those kind of things that we worked really hard in achieving those agreements. We ended up, we're in trial, we're picking a jury, and I get grabbed by one of the assistant state's attorneys, and she says, the attorney general and the governor want you in Fort Lauderdale. And we were trying a case in West Palm Beach. And so we take off and go down, and of course we don't tell anybody, and we make some excuse. So we get down there, the governor's there, the AG's there, and two of the top national negotiators for Philip Morris and RJR, which had about 65% of all of the exposure. And so they really were running the show. We were all seated in one room, and they told the governor, said, "We want to settle the case with you. We think it's an extremely good case. We know you're ready for it. We know that you're prepared to take a verdict in it, but we want to pay you top dollar to get this thing settled." And the governor very calmly looked at him and said, "I'm not worried about the money," said, "I'm worried about all of the non-economic things, because I'm either going to be criticized or remembered because of those things. No one wanted to become involved in this politically from the other side of the aisle, but they're going to enjoy and reap the benefits from it. But more importantly, we can do so much to discourage smoking in our youth that I will be remembered for that. And it's that important to me."
And that's really the societal change that you try to go after as a trial lawyer, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's to make a difference, and to make a significant difference. They said, we can't do that, Governor. Says, "We've got a national agenda, and we can't commit to giving you that and still maintain that course." He said, "Well, I'm very sorry, but the trial team's here, the trial team's picking a jury, and it's going to stay that way, and we're going to take a verdict. I'm sorry, you all are a very nice gentleman and very professional, but can't do business with you." And so we all left. Week and a half later, I get grabbed out again. They said, "Okay, says we got to go to Fort Lauderdale again." So we zoomed down to Fort Lauderdale. So the governor is in North Carolina, but he calls us, and Joe Rice and I are there, and we had been talking with the companies all along. And he said, "Fellas, they have given us all of the non-economic that was requested. The signs will come down from the schools within 1,000 feet of the schools almost immediately. They'll be gone, period, within a reasonable period of time. The Association of Sports and Tobacco is going to be radically different than it was before. And the targeting of children and looking at stores that have big ads making it cool to smoke that are the height of 5-year-olds is going to stop." And he said, "I think we have done a very good job in doing that. And Mike, you and Joe, take care of the money. Whatever you settle for, I'm okay with it."
Wow. That's a heavy responsibility.
Yeah, it was.
Was that the case so far in your career that you've been most proud of?
I think so. You're proud of things for different reasons. And there are individual cases that I've handled that have made such a difference in an individual's life that you feel very good about it. And that's what you're supposed to be able to do. But this affected so many people and as it relates, is still affecting people. We changed the culture by doing that. We had the deposition of Jeffrey Bible in our case in Florida, and for the first time, an executive in tobacco at the highest level, and he was the CEO of Philip Morris, said smoking causes cancer and nicotine is addictive and made all the difference in the world.
Yeah, you never heard them say that.
And just a few short years before, you had members of the industry swearing before Congress that they didn't know the answer to those questions.
You have been a lawyer since 1969. You graduated locally here from Rollins College. Then you went on to Stetson University College of Law. Mike, what made you want to be a lawyer?
It's very interesting. My dad was in the building business. He was undergoing some surgery at 38 years old and sat me down the Sunday before the Monday he was going to go in the hospital. He says, Mike, he says, you're the oldest. You're the only boy. Your mother is 6 months pregnant with what's going to be your third sister. He says, if something happens to me, you're going to be the man of the house. And he said, I know that you want to go into engineering, and you certainly could do it, but I want you to do one of two things. I want you to be a doctor or a lawyer. And he said, you can do a great deal of good by both of those things. Well, 4 days later, he died of a staph infection and gastric gangrene. So that's something I'll never forget. And he actually, because of that, remained my mentor and led me to law school and led me to the practice of law.
Wow. How old were you at that time?
I was 15 when my dad died.
That's a pretty heady responsibility. What were the most important influences in your life growing up, or especially lessons that you learned that prepared you, guide you during your law career?
Well, when my dad died, my mother went on to deliver her six-month child at the time at 9 months. And we were not in a particularly good economic position. And my dad was a very bright guy, but he hadn't had it time enough to really make the name for himself that he would have made for himself had he died. So economically, it was just understood that the checks that we all made, mostly my sister that was 13 months younger than me and myself, were handed to my mother. She taught us about frugality. She taught us about study. There wasn't any question, you're going to school and you're going to study hard and you're going to do well and you're going to compete. And she was someone that just barely graduated from high school. Sometimes I think she was fibbing about that. But she was a brilliant woman.
You mentioned your dad was certainly a mentor of yours. Were there others along the way?
We were very fortunate when I first began doing personal injury work to have the Perry Nichols of the world still alive. All the members of the Nichols team were superstars. Bill Hicks and Bill Coulson and J.B. Spence and Ray Ferrero, Bill Wagner, Bill Whitaker, who practiced here in this area. All of them were real examples of trying a case at the highest level of competence for personal injury lawyers.
Mike, how did you go about honing your trial skills?
When I started practicing, I was able to get a job at one office, and it was the only offer I had, so I took it. And it was a general practice firm that did a lot of litigation. And I was fortunate, although I didn't know it at the time, that a couple of weeks after I started with the firm, I'd already passed the bar. A case came up for trial in criminal court, and the client didn't pay any money. And so my boss at the time says, "You're going to get to try that case by yourself." I'd never set foot in a criminal case. So I got a book on criminal law and how to pick a jury and do those kind of things. And I prepared for it. I really, the Sunday night before, and I'll never forget it, before the trial began, I went to the neighborhood of the three eyewitnesses who were going to be witnesses for the prosecution to say that my client broke into a window and stole a purse off of a chest. Well, I went out and I talked to all the ladies on this Sunday night. And they thought it was amazing that this young kid was coming to talk to them and showed a real interest in them. And we got to the trial, and I knew enough to invoke the rule. So the witnesses were all taken back and separated and told not to talk to one another. I asked each of them a series of questions, one of which was, "What night did this happen on?" And then I asked him about, "Okay, there were three windows there in the back of this house. Is that correct?" "Yes." Says, "Which window did he break into?" And so by the time it was all over, it was three different windows and three different times. And I'd argued enough about beyond the exclusion of reasonable doubt and the requirement that the state had to prove the case against them, and they haven't done it in this case. So my client was acquitted. I left that firm after about a year and 8 months, and I went with another firm that did only personal injury work. I was one of six lawyers, and we were handling a large number of cases, and we were expected to have 50% of our cases in suit. So you had an opportunity to really try a lot of cases. And I tried everything I could just because I was relatively good at it. So my boss encouraged me to continue doing it. But I can remember every Thursday we'd have a meeting of all the lawyers. And if you didn't have a case on the docket on Monday and somebody else had two, then you can volunteer for one. I always volunteered. And so I'd get the case on Thursday, I'd read the file, and I'd go try the case. Mm-hmm. And trying all those cases to verdicts, almost impossible today because of the way that the industry is run.
What's the most rewarding part of being a plaintiff's lawyer to you?
To me, it's being able to make an injured person's life more bearable and to get them an economic recovery that makes life easier for them and for them to be able to face the daily challenges of life that they can't do because of injuries.
Is there one key to your success, any one skill?
I'm not afraid to try a case. I'll always prepare as much as I can to deliver the most effective protection for my client. I'm innovative in the way that I handle things, and just because somebody has never done it before doesn't mean that it can't be done and that I might be successful at doing it. I'll give an example. I had a case in Tampa. A police officer who worked for the Wildwood Police Department and was very early, pre-dawn in the morning, was directing traffic off of the interstate heading south. And he parked his car, and he was at the front of his car waving with a light. And this car came up over a hill. He was pretty close to the hill. And they weren't speeding particularly, but they ended up and slammed on the brakes. And the guy runs around the front of the car, the police officer, and they hit the bumper, knock it off, and it follows him about 15 feet, hits him and breaks his leg very badly. He was off from work for about 2 years, and he gained a lot of weight. And the defense lawyer was going to have a fat guy defense. And so we go before Judge Kovacevich, who's a federal judge in Tampa, also Stetson grad, very, very smart judge, and capable judge, no nonsense. So we pick the jury, and the defendant had used all his challenges, and the jury was about 4 out of 6 clearly overweight. And it made me feel good because I figured it was going to be detrimental to the defense lawyer. So I said, Bob, I said, I'm going to make you the deal of a lifetime. I said, you only got $200,000 in coverage. And I said the likelihood of a verdict over $200,000 is 100 to 1. And so that's going to happen. I said, but here's what we'll do. We'll let the jury go. We'll agree with the judge that we will present the case to her an hour apiece, no witnesses, no appeal, and it'll be binding. He says, let me call my client. So he calls his client, comes back, says, it's a deal. And the judge was delighted, of course, because it was 2 weeks of trial that she didn't have to face. Sure. And she ended up and awarded a substantial amount of money that put a percentage on our client, and there was a comp lien, but she knew there was a comp lien. Okay, so she knew exactly what she was doing. And what I argued was, yes, our guy was to some degree at fault, okay, but it was certainly less than 50%. And it turned out very, very well for the client.
What role does ego play in being a successful attorney?
I think ego can be used positively and it can be used negatively. And some people abuse ego and it becomes lacking in productivity. I believe in doing the best case. I want to be proud of doing all that can be done for the client. And I want to achieve the highest and best result that I can to make that client's life better.
How do you handle disappointment?
I go in very early the next morning. I work harder.
Mike, among your many, many achievements, you've been a former president of the Association of Trial Lawyers in America. You're a former president of the Florida Justice Association. You're an Eagle founder and in the Eagle Hall of Fame at the Florida Justice Association, winner of the Al J. Cohn Lifetime Achievement Award, BJ Masterson Award. The list goes on and on. How has your involvement with the Florida Justice Association impacted your career?
To be on the board and to be an officer is something I'll never forget. I'm a big believer in doing the right thing for the right reason. And when I was doing it, I knew we were doing the right thing for the right reason. And it was very hard work because we would spend a lot of time in Tallahassee and a lot of times going around the state keeping people advised as to what we were doing. I had, you asked about mentors before, I didn't mention Aaron Podhurst and I didn't mention Larry Stewart. Larry was the president before I was, and then Fred Hazzuri was the president after I was. So all of those guys fit, from example, very important people to me.
Was there one particular issue that stood out that you worked on while you were involved heavily with FJA?
There were several, but the one that I remember somewhat poetically is the interest rate. I think it was 4% at the time on any judgment, which was very unfair because we were up around 8, maybe 10 at given points in time during that time period. And we very quietly, not listening in on our agenda of what we wanted, worked like crazy on it. Talking about respecting people, Lee Moffitt and Ralph Abin are two real examples of people that were terrific public officials.
What words of wisdom have proven true to you along the way?
I mentioned the phrase, do the right thing for the right reason. It sounds very simplistic, And it is simplistic, but it's very hard to do consistently.
Mike, you're married, have two children, one of which, Steve, is a principal here in your law firm. How do you balance your professional life with your family life?
It's very, very difficult. And on occasion, my wife says I don't balance it very well. Well, it's a lot easier now because I'm at an age I'm not working as much as I was before, particularly being active in the academy and active in what was ATLA at the time I was president. My wife was really good about it and exceptionally good mother, and my kids were, I think, proud of what I was doing, and we included them and going to the meetings and going to the conventions and doing those kinds of things and doing things like that. Right. It was an interesting time.
It must be a thrill to have one of your sons be practicing in the firm that has your name. It's a family legacy.
It is. He's a lot smarter than I am and a lot better lawyer than I was.
What about regrets? Do you have any?
There have been cases that we've lost that I really, really feel bad about. And there have been cases that we've lost on appeal that we got very good results at the trial court. I feel really bad for the clients in those situations. If you care about your clients, it affects you. And I don't like the feeling of losing. So we do everything we can to avoid it. But it happens. If you try a lot of cases, there's going to be a time that something happens that you can't control. And a lot of times that's with the court.
What's your view on the future of the legal profession? Do you have concerns?
I do have concerns, and there have been concerns that I've had the entire time I've practiced law. When you represent the downtrodden, there are a lot of people that don't appreciate what you do. And you have to be able to stand that pressure of people being critical of what is an honorable pursuit.
It's been said you don't really appreciate a trial lawyer until you need one.
It's true. We have clients that really appreciate what we're doing. And I think that doing a good job is the best way to get clients.
What one piece of advice do you have for incoming lawyers?
There are a lot of people that are begrudging the state of the legal profession today. I tell anyone that asks me about going to law school, I said, go to law school, because it will change your life. You may never try a case, but you will think in a different way that is very logical, and it'll help you in any profession that you end up in.
Mike, how would you like to be remembered?
I'd like to be remembered as someone who faced the challenge and was competent of providing help to a client and making a difference, sometimes for thousands and thousands of people or millions and millions of people. That's something to be proud of, I think.
Mike Mayer, you are a titan of trial. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Paul Jess. We hope you enjoyed listening to this Titans of Trial episode. If you're not already a member, we'd like to invite you to join the Florida Justice Association. Please visit us on the web at floridajusticeassociation.org or drop us a line at radio@floridajusticeassociation.org.
Thank you for listening to this Titans of Trial podcast, sponsored by the Florida Justice Association Research and Education Foundation, promoting the study and understanding of Florida's civil justice system and how its preservation benefits consumers, victims, and all Floridians. Learn more at floridajusticeassociation.org.